FW presents Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 plus years of comics history each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist from Max Reads Comics, Max Traver. Hi, Max.
Hi. Hi, how you doing?
So is this your first podcast appearance, is it?
This is my first on-mic podcast appearance, yes.
You've been off-mic?
Yeah, I've been on comments and Facebook posts and lurking all around like that, but I've never let anyone have the pleasure of hearing my voice.
Well, watch out. It's catching. You know, like you, I'm a power blogger, but you know, once you start podcasting, you're going, this might work better as a podcast.
Yeah, I've had those thoughts, and then I also have the thoughts about how much work I've heard the editing is, so that scared me away so far.
Well, Panel by Panel is perfect for that, because my own rhythm is about, you know, whatever the recording time is, it takes about three times that to edit. So Panel by Panel, by virtue of being 15 to 20 minutes...
It's not bad.
Yeah, it's a good investment.
The first one is free kind of situations.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good place to try yourself out in your case. Uh-huh. And you did volunteer for this.
Yes.
As most guests do. I've forced very few people. Maybe Ryan Daly the first time. And that relates to this because, as you'll see, we use a randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, either physical or digital. And prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally a panel, which we'll discuss as the discrete unit of comic book storytelling. In this case, we rolled... The year, 1941. Oh, the month of August. Among all the comics out that month, the revolving finger falls on Star Spangled Comics number 1, which actually shows an actual cover date of October. Page 43 of 63 possible pages, which means it will be the Armstrong of the Army story by Ed Moore Jr. And no, I've never heard of Armstrong of the Army before either. I'm guessing on your part as well.
Never.
Yeah. Panel 8 of 8, which you'll find in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Do you like Golden Age comics in general? Because this is a particular example.
Yeah, actually, comics of the 40s are kind of a fascination of mine in the last few years. And one of the things I'm covering on my little blog right now is just one issue of Smash Comics from 1941 that is taking me a long time to cover because there's so many features. It's like this one. It's like 60-something pages long.
The basic Golden Age. I mean, Star Spangled Comics, of course, famous for introducing Star Spangled Kid and Stripesy, which were a Jerry Siegel creation, and they made a lot of hay about it. And when you look at books from the era, there's like Superman is hosting an ad for the Star Spangled Kid. But it's also got the first appearance of the Tarantula, who would become a bigger deal in All-Star Squadron. And, you know, Army men stuff. Army, yeah. Navy, Air Force characters. And this is what I know of Armstrong of the Army from just research. He is Army intelligence.
Yes.
He's a lieutenant. He never got a first name. His strip lasted 6 issues of Star Spangled Comics. And then... he was never heard from again.
Yeah, it had to do with the bats, I'm sure.
Yes, this is a very batty panel. Would you do the honors and describe it for us?
Absolutely. What we have is a rectangular panel with a featureless crimson background. And Armstrong of the Army, we're to assume at least, a man in a military uniform, is basically tilted to the side in the center of the panel, afloat, again with no background, and surrounded by silhouettes of what the one dialogue balloon helps us understand is supposed to be bats. They're very crudely drawn, almost like children's Halloween decoration silhouettes of bats surrounding him. And there is a giant word balloon with the blue bold lettered word bats with an exclamation point. And that is the entire detail of the panel.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I almost wish Ryan Daly had gotten this panel by, you know, randomly. Because if people remember last April 1st, the origin of this show is that, you know, we did a sort of a kind of show where Batman panel by panel. And Ryan Daly and I sort of made like we were going through Batman from 1940 on through, you know, chronologically, one panel per show. And we got to like episode 1004 or something in the context of the April Fool's show. But then people started saying, oh, well, maybe you should try to do this for real. Not with Batman, not chronologically, because that takes forever, but, you know, just random panels, random or selected. Yeah. The way that Ryan was feeling through that original experience was that, oh, haven't we seen this before? Isn't this the same imagery as before? How many times do we need to see the, you know, the moon in the sky and the car crossing the bridge? But this looks like it was taken out of a Batman comic.
Oh, easily. Yeah. This could be Batman Year One if, you know, Bruce Wayne was in the army.
Yeah. You know, my first feeling just looking at it, obviously I know it's a Armstrong strip and that this is probably, it isn't just probably, it is Armstrong if you look at the rest of the comic, but it's like, because it looks so Batman-ish, my first assumption is, oh, this guy's a villain or an intruder in the Batcave. That's what it feels like. The army's found the Batcave.
Yeah. It definitely seems like the bats are, you know, something for the character to be worried about, like they're an obstacle of some kind. You know, like he's definitely not okay that the bats are here all of a sudden. You know, like it's there's something upsetting about it, is what you'd think from this one panel.
Yeah, well, this is the way the posture. He's putting his hand to his mouth. It's almost like it stinks. There is a smell or a, you know, like he's holding back revulsion, keeping from throwing up or something. You know, it's like, oh, he's shocked.
Yeah, you cue the Ace Ventura guano soundbite, you know.
Okay, here.
Yummy!
But even the what you call crimson, but, you know, almost to the eye, hot pink background, that plus the posture plus the way the letters of the word bats are jostled, all of it is, you know, manifests shock. Armstrong is shocked and it's like suddenly everything disappears except the bats. So we're sort of in his headspace.
Yeah, actually that ties into what I did a little research on, since we had so few elements to work with here. I figured, you know, let's assume this was on purpose and all of these elements were placed here for a reason and everything else was dropped out for a similar reason. So I looked at the symbolism of bats and the color red. And that sense of him being, you know, lost or knocked off balance by this ties into what I looked up on, you know, the general dream symbolism of bats. And, you know, let's say the creator was Ed Moore, I believe. Let's say he knew all of this going forward. And in this little 4 or 5 page story, he wanted to put this deeply symbolic thing in there. And bats, if you buy into this sort of thing, when they're seen in dreams specifically, they are something that leads you through adverse situations to a solution. They guide you through a time of transition or a major, they're a guide through a major change or transition. And they,
from millionaire playboy to vigilante.
Right. But specifically, they help you know when to move on, what to do and how to find what you're looking for. And, you know, so basically they're a guide. You're going through turmoil, but the bats are here. And I guess that ties into, on maybe even a subconscious level, the bats having echolocation and that they can find their way in the dark, you know. And so they're seen as someone that can, or something that can help you find your way through a bad time.
Now, I know you looked at the story. I know. Yes. I know you gave yourself a little more context than this.
Yes.
Do the bats indeed guide our man to something?
In fact, they do. He is chasing saboteurs at this point who have shot down a plane, an army intelligence plane, and they've shot down the plane and stolen film from it, aerial surveillance film. And then Armstrong and his newly found friend on the base rammed that plane with their car. You know, the saboteurs took off in their own getaway car. Armstrong shot the tires out and then he lost sight of the bad guys. So he comes up over this ridge or hill and he is suddenly surrounded by bats in this panel. And he just figures they were disturbed by something and sees where they flew out from and they lead him to the cave that the saboteurs are hiding in.
So it works.
Yeah, it absolutely works out. The symbolism lines up with what actually happens in the story. And not only that, but when Armstrong fights the bats in the or fights the saboteurs in the cave, he wins, but he also ends up trapped in a whirlpool. But he's saved by his colleague. I guess they're not, it's not clear if they know each other. I think it's just someone who met him on the base, who followed the bats as well and brought a rope to pull Armstrong out of the whirlpool. So they saved him. They helped him once and saved his life another time.
Wow. So so the symbolism of it, you could say Ed Moore knew about this or that it was part of the story or just subconsciously, the same way that dreams might mean this. Well, they might mean this in a subconscious on a subconscious level. So the artist choosing to use bats is also working from a subconscious image of the bat. It's, you know, it's a, the archetypal bat. It's the Jungian bat.
I'm absolutely sure that somewhere Grant Morrison has already examined this panel in much the same way. Like, like this has to have been part of his like giant library of clippings in his room of madness or wherever he writes from, you know.
It all happened.
Yes.
Including this. I do have to say that I like Ed Moore is not a well-known name. And if you look up his credits, he's got, you know, a smattering of credits through to the 50s, working in different anthology books. And obviously this strip did not survive more than, you know, more than six issues. But I like his line. I like the thickness of it. I like how it's very much, if you, even the rest of the comic is, you've got blocks of color, basically. So the thick line delineating the character and the environment, the cars, and then not much shading, not much cross-hatching, not much in a way of detail inside the block, you know, the illustrative block. It's a very, very simple, but even within those small lines, you get your real posture, real a real way of showing textiles, yep, clothing on a person. And then when he drops out the background here, just to, so that the bats, it's not done cheaply. It's not done to save time. You know, it's an eye-popping panel. It shows shock. It's used to show emotion.
Yeah, he doesn't necessarily skimp on the backgrounds and all the other panels. Like you said, the simplicity feels like a choice because you mentioned his detail of how clothing works on people. And in this very panel, the few lines he puts on those green pants shows a better knowledge of drapery than I think you see in most comics anywhere. Like, it looks like he's wearing a real pair of pants, and he didn't have to put that effort in there. I've read a lot of these 1940s comics, and they were done by people who looked like they were running from someone as they were drawing the comic in a lot of cases. But he put that extra effort, and those his clothes look like they're from a fashion catalog. Like, here's how they're going to hang.
Yeah, you say that, and it's like the image I got, I immediately came to mind is the Flash, Golden Age Flash. I don't remember the name of the artist, but it's one of the most the crudest Golden Age strips to actually make to be big. You know, Flash wasn't just popular; it was in Flash Comics, but then in All Flash as well. So you got you know a lot of Flash material, and the artwork is pretty poor even for the era. And it's really like everybody went to war and there was one guy left to draw it. And so a guy running, you know, running and drawing at the same time, sort of.
Yeah, he's got to get the copy from three other jobs to an office, and he also has to finish this issue.
Yeah, you know? And it works because he's drawing the Flash.
So, right, so right. Running. That was probably the idea. Maybe if we make him run, it'll turn out better.
But in this case, it's not like the super detailed war comics that we get later from DC, for example. You know, it's not Joe Kubert or anything, but I like that simple line. I like the way it's used, and we probably got the better panel of the entire strip.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would say a lot of nice things about this artist in comparison to even a lot of the art in the same issue. Like even the title feature I thought was the worst looking thing in the book. Mm. You know, but this is not Russ Heath as far as like the detail. It's very clean storytelling. It's very effective. At no point are you confused. There's only one part where they use those that I'm finding are very common in 1940s books, the arrows that tell you, read this panel next, now go to this one because I didn't draw the page correctly. But even on that page, it doesn't hurt it that badly. It just seems like, well, rather than fix it, I'll put these arrows in.
We also get an idea of what the Batman symbol might have looked like. You know, let's say the simplified Batman logo emblem is the correct one, because here we're looking at actual silhouettes of bats, and they've got, you know, more rounded ears, maybe. They've got little legs sticking out. So it's the Batman logo with extras, you know?
Yeah, you can't have the feet if you want to look like someone that's going to take advantage of a cowardly and superstitious lot. You can't have dangly little feet with cute little paws on the ends.
Or those rounded ears that, you know, they're yeah. kind of spiky, but there's some rounded ones which anatomically correct. It's, you know, they're flying mice. But
yeah, bats are actually quite cute if you can get past the big leathery wings, and you don't want that for Batman's chest logo or Frank Miller shooting target or whatever they want to rationalize it as.
Geez. And I kind of like the cap here as well. It's supposed to be, you know, there's an eagle on the cap, but in the simplified way that Ed Moore draws it, it looks like a little atom or half of an atom, which to me is like atomic age stuff. And I don't know, it kind of speaks to me as well as a comic book reader, even though that I know that's not what it is.
Yeah, I think just reading this era of comic, though, you're kind of almost, again, we're back to the subconscious. You're looking for subconsciously, you're looking for that kind of symbolism, even if it isn't there. Or maybe like you were saying, Ed Moore might have accidentally slipped it in there when he was simplifying the eagle because of what was on his mind. But of course, we didn't have the atomic bomb incident in Japan yet. I'm not sure. I'm not a huge history buff, so I don't know if the H-bomb was in people's minds at the time.
Oh, I mean, this is what we said, 1941. That's probably much too early for that.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. And also, you know, the U.S. wasn't in the war yet at that point.
Yeah, that's one thing that has, like when I'm doing my coverage of that Smash Comics issue and then looking at this one and some others, there's a lot of, you know, rah-rah get the Nazis stuff in these books, and the U.S. hadn't entered the war yet. So I get the feeling that a lot of the people in the, you know, just even in the pool of cartoonists were sort of pushing for, we want to get in this thing. We want to do something.
Yeah. I mean, Captain America punching Hitler, that famous cover is like from 1941. So people, you know, were willing and had their, you know, their hearts were in it for it. But the political reality hadn't caught up.
Yeah. I've always known, of course, about that cover, but I hadn't read a lot of 1940s books before this past year and a half or so. And I had sort of like crystallized that cap cover in amber, like that was the one team, like Joe and Jack, they wanted to go to war, you know. But it turns out, not surprisingly, a lot of people felt this way.
Yeah, it's like you're seeing, well, and there was the fear of fifth columnists and people bringing fascism over. I mean, that would never happen. So people were seeing, you know, there's an evil in the world. And so they make ready villains for our heroes, you know.
And fifth columnist, I actually just looked that term up for where it really comes from just like this past month. I did not know the historical origins of the term fifth columnist until recently.
You should tell us.
Well, I don't remember exactly, so it was probably bad of me to bring it up. But there was a general who was marching his army on a city, and he had four columns marching, and he referred to the fifth column as the attitude of resistance. I would really need to look up the specific details, and probably also realize that when you're talking on something that's going to be recorded, you should have your notes up more.
but I can imagine that, you know, in the context that they're used with the Nazis, it's like the fifth column is like a secret column of, you know, on the inside.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it was specifically about the resistance he had already within the city they were marching on, that he had a fifth column in his back pocket. This will give plenty of bait for the real history buffs to come in and correct and add real details, which will be good for me.
It's called engagement.
Yes, sure.
Well, thank you, Max. Tell people what you're working on right now, where to find your blog.
My blog, which is pretty new, is at maxreadscomics.wordpress.com. And I cover new books that I've read in the past week or so. I do indie comic spotlights on new books that are, they're very independent. And I also occasionally just do a deep dive on older books that I like, just really, it's something that keeps me accountable. So I'm not just buying tons of comics and saying, there, now I have them. You know, I have to read them and say something about them. That's how it started. So it's just there for me to check in and take accountability for this gigantic hobby of mine that I've had all my life.
Yeah, it's a little bit why I started as well.
Yeah.
12 or 13 years ago now. Oof. Yeah, well, I'll let you go back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo, and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode. Thanks, Max.
Thanks.
Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin. Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins, the new Jason Todd, Millennium?
You're not doing this right. Let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle.
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh, yeah.
Son of the Demon.
The Killing Joke.
A Death in the Family.
Batman Year 3.
A Lonely Place of Dying.
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allen Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
And now feedback from the last episode, comment by comment. We called that previous show Another Fridge? Because it did feature a fridge, this one from Love and Rockets, 1994 effort, Wig Wham Bam graphic novel by Jaime Hernandez. And my guest was Rick Heineken from Unpacking the Power Pack. Let's look at what people thought of it. Robert Kelly says, we really need to think about reaching out to Frigidaire to sponsor this show. Brian Linton says, this panel and the panel of the Things Refrigerator exploits got me wondering how much of our lives we spend standing in front of an open refrigerator. The closest thing to this that I could find was from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. They estimated that the average U.S. citizen spent 0.59 hours a day doing food preparation and cleanup in 2018, which would include taking things in and out of the fridge. Unfortunately, I don't know if that estimate also includes time spent looking in the fridge while deciding what to eat. Regardless, that would give us an upper bound, i.e. assuming all of that time was spent in front of the fridge, or approximately 9 days out of the year spent standing in front of a fridge. In reality, the average time will be less than this, but this at least gives us some frame of reference when considering the frequency of people standing in front of the fridges in comic books versus in real life. He says, thanks for another excellent episode. I'm already looking forward to the next refrigerator-filled panel, though I'd be satisfied with the appearance of any major household appliance. Well, we'll keep checking for those. Max Traver, who was on this very episode, said, who could have expected so much Legion of Superheroes content in one episode about one panel from one randomly chosen comic book? Personally, I blame the fact that I ate a miracle machine. But I made some hay about the character being dressed a lot like what I felt was Shrinking Violet. But, you know, later I thought, I keep seeing it as green and pink, and that cut, that it's also She-Hulk at some point. So there's that in my mind as well. David S. Gutierrez says, so this is just a really Kaufman-esque bit that's going the distance. And I can't answer that question, David. I don't know if you mean Andy or Charlie. Chris Franklin says, interesting discussion, although I think as fridge discussions go, you can't beat the original. He was on that. He says, I kid, some great insights. My knowledge of Love and Rockets is very minimal, even though I remember seeing ads for it way back in the old comic collector magazine of the 80s. It was way too adult for me then. I love Hernandez's clean style. A mundane panel like this is just a joy to look at. As for refrigerators, here's hoping your randomizer steers clear of Green Lantern comics. Let's not speak of that ever again. But yeah, I guess this show's becoming something of a fridge magnet. Jack Bond says, great fridge. Okay. It's even got a mesh cover at the bottom for the ventilation for the coils. I went back to check the thing's ventilation, and it's got a cover, but they do a strange M.C. Escher disappearing act from left to right. The calendar on the fridge seems to have more than 1 month, I guess three across, so it'll be hard to pin these events to a specific day. And then we get Eric says, incidentally, one of your guesses about the panel was pretty accurate. Maggie's pointing out that there is a Have You Seen Me picture of Hopi on the orange juice carton. Hopi is unamused. Rob Kelly returns later in the conversation, says this episode reminds me that I have not read a single issue of Love and Rockets, which is a shameful oversight since I consider myself well-versed in the comic book medium, at least pre-2000s. I've always loved Hernandez Brothers' artwork, so I really need to pick up a trade or two. Captain Entropy says, Rob, I'm the exact same position regarding Love and Rockets, and I haven't even listened to the episode of Panel by Panel yet. None of that has stopped me from enjoying this comment thread. Well, we made these to be listened to, but if you just want to read, have at it. Martin Gray says, brilliant episode. Thanks, chaps. When it was at its peak of trendiness, I tried a couple of issues of Love and Rockets, but it wasn't for me. Great art, though. He says, we've never had missing kids on consumer products over here. Perhaps we lack missing kids. So do sad photos on milk cartons not depress people getting into the day? And I'm with Martin. I've never seen a picture on a milk carton in Canada either, or you know, on a milk bag, which is something we have here, which I guess would be more complicated to print. Bryn Linton came in to show us his research. He did a little digging, and it appears that the practice of printing the photos of missing children on milk cartons was a relatively short-lived phenomenon of the 1980s. Apparently, it began with a local dairy in Des Moines, Iowa, in 1984 and spread from there, but the practice died out by the late 80s. It seems that the only people paying attention to the milk carton kids were other kids who stared at the photos each morning while eating breakfast, and those photos just ended up scaring them. It doesn't sound like milk carton kids ever became a thing outside the U.S. And let's finish here with Ward Hill Terry, who says the panel is such a marvelous composition. There is a clear sense of depth. The humans and furnishings are in scale with each other. The lines are solid. There's no wasted line. The only use of a shadow technique is to delineate the cabinets, which in turn helps to define the space between the fridge and the interior wall. Character relationships are clear. I'm mad for Jaime Hernandez's art. I strongly encourage you all, Siskoid, Rob, Chris, Martin, Captain, to read Love and Rockets, but don't start at the beginning. The Hernandez brothers rapidly develop their own styles, but the stories that they ultimately tell are the meat of their work. If you have the individual issues, Siskoid, I recommend starting with number 10 for Gilbert's or Beto's story. He initially sets his tales in Palomar, somewhere south of the U.S. border. His work eventually takes a truly epic, though human, scope, spanning generations and nations. But it's all tied back to these first tales in Palomar. These are collected in Love and Rockets Library number 2, Heartbreak Soup, which ought to be standard reading in English lit classes. For Jaime's work, I suggest starting no earlier than number 12. Here you can meet most of the main characters in a very realistic setting. The early issues feature a lot of science fiction elements from both brothers. From these starting points, those elements are quietly pushed aside, but not dismissed, to be more character-driven. I got into it because it reminded me of a more realistic version of Archie comics. These can be found in Love and Rockets Library number 3, The Girl from Hoppers. Both brothers let the characters grow, age, and change. Their drawing styles are distinctly different, but their works are masterpieces in wedding the minimum amount of words with perfect illustrations and with no unnecessary line work. Well, that's a great advertisement for Love and Rockets. Thank you, Ward Hill Terry. A reminder that we are now on Patreon, that is to say the Fire and Water Podcast Network. If you enjoy this kind of material, please think about leaving a donation, either a punctual one or a monthly one. You can find all the information at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Thanks in advance. And of course, if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You don't even have to have any experience, just like our guest today. You'll be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. So my thanks again to my guest, Max Traver. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.